Hey, Henry, I think this, can you turn this monitor off for me? Thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, I'm going to start with talking about The Wizard of Oz. How many of you seen The Wizard of Oz? How many of you saw it when it was in the theaters? That would be 1939, just so you know. Okay, all right, guys. I don't want to date you, but it's 1939. So I wonder if you, most of us know the story of the Wizard of Oz, but how many of us know that really it's a political allegory? Now, I know I'm about to ruin this for you, but that, I mean, think about what was happening in the time when he wrote, when Frank Baum wrote this book, was the country had been sort of, particularly the Midwest of the country, the farmers of our country, were in a political uproar, an economic uproar, because they had shifted from the silver standard to the gold standard. And one of the things was that the farmers and were pitted against the sort of political and economic regime of New York City. And so we're going to talk about that in a second, but that's what was happening when the book was written. So now, once the book is written, I want you to think about the similarities, right? So it's when Dorothy is taken up in the political and upheaval of a tornado, right? The tornado symbolizes this upheaval. She goes to the land of Oz, right? O-Z. That is an abbreviation for ounce, the measure that gold and silver are measured in, right? Now, when she gets there, who is her? Who's the antagonist? Who's the bad guy? The Wicked Witch of the East, right? She comes in, and who's the East? New York City. And I grew up in Louisiana, so New York City's always bad, right? There's no good. There's nothing good that comes from New York City. Just kidding. But for Frank Baum, this is what was going on. And the people in New York City, the bankers and lawyers, they were the ones who made this decision, and the farmers are the ones left to deal with what was going to happen. So now, we're in this story, and Dorothy is given this great advice. What is their advice? We are to follow the yellow brick road. Right? Yellow bricks. Gold. Right? We're seeing that. So they follow the yellow brick road. That's how she's going to get back to Kansas. But she follows the yellow brick road. And of course, there's all the stuff, that bad stuff that happens. And she gets to Oz. And what does she find out about the wizard? He's a fraud. He's, don't pay attention to the man behind the curtain, right? She pulls the curtain aside. There he is. He's a fraud. The yellow brick road led her into fraud. Now, how does she get home? She clicks her slippers together. Now, in 1939, the slippers were ruby because they had just come out with Technicolor, and they wanted to show off the vibrant colors of Technicolor. So they made them ruby. But in the book, the slippers are silver. And she clicks her silver slippers together. Where does she go? She goes home. She had it all the while. Silver was the best way to go. Now, I'm not telling you, most of you might say, well, what's the point of this other than ruining the story for me? It's like, I'm going to go home and write a book report about this or something. And it's awful, right? The point is that I'm going to talk about what Daniel is doing in this story when he has this vision. See, the problem is we don't have a genre of literature like what Daniel is doing here. It's called apocalyptic. So the definition of the word apocalypse is it means to uncover. And this is our first slide. So our first slide says that the apocalypse, it doesn't mean the end of the world. That's not what that means, although that's what it's come to mean for us, right? But apocalypse is from the Greek word that means to uncover something or to pull the curtain back and look behind and see what's going on. That's what apocalypse is. And that's what kind of literature Daniel is. It is called apocalyptic literature. Now, here's the thing. Apocalyptic literature is not a roadmap to the end of the world. It's not a theological crossword puzzle that we put together and then we can tell the time of the end. That's not the point. It does tell us about the end of the world, but that is not it's not a roadmap to give us the direction. It is an encouragement to live faithfully in the present. That's what Daniel is doing. That's what the book of Revelation is doing. We tend to try to figure out, who is the beast, and we try to figure out all these weird things. But that's not what this is about. The book of Daniel, Revelation, all these books are meant to help us to live faithfully now, here in the present, knowing that God is in control. And so, once again, I want to tell you, I've told this every time we've talked about Daniel. What is the bottom line of Daniel? Here's the bottom line. future is secure, we can endure. Now, I know that's cheesy and grimy, but it gets the point across, right? Daniel wants to tell us that the future is secure. And because the future is secure, we can endure everything that is thrown at us. Now, and that goes all the way back to chapter 1. In chapter 1, it tells us that Daniel tells us that God was raising up Babylon, and he brought in Babylon to destroy Israel, to teach Israel a lesson, to punish Israel, right? That's the whole point. So what Daniel tells us all along is that God has a plan for how history is going to turn out. He is moving things. God is somehow able to work in kings and presidents and emperors and dictators. He's able to move his world the way he wants it to go. And God has a direction he wants it to go. And because he is the one who is ultimately in charge, everything's going to be okay. Everything is secure. We don't have to worry about how the world's going to turn out, if everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket. Guess what? It's not going to go that way. Because God is in control. The future is secure. We can endure. Now, what does this mean? So let's talk about this vision. In the vision, we have, uses language, and it's, we don't have any other way of describing what's happened. I want you to think about Daniel. Daniel and his friends watched as the Babylon came down into Israel and tore the temple of God down stone by stone. This is the building that God lived in. It's not like our sanctuary. God doesn't live in here, right? But in Israel, the temple was the symbol of God's presence. It was the symbol of God's kingdom. And it was torn down stone from stone. How would you describe that? What language could you use to describe what that meant to you? There is no language. There's only the language of monsters and demons and nightmares. Think about 9/11 when we watched as those buildings came down. There were no words to describe what was going on in our lives. And that's why we used apocalyptic language. We said things like, it felt as if the world stopped turning that day. Right? Did it stop turning? Of course not. But it didn't yield. Yeah, but that's the only language we have available to describe what, and that the language that Daniel has to describe what's happening. Think about it. He says there are the four great winds of heaven came and blew about the sea, and the sea is a symbol of chaos in the ancient Near East. And out of the sea comes these great four beasts. They're like nightmares, right? And that's the language of apocalypse. That's the language that's also used in Revelation. It's the language it's nightmare language. And think about it. If you've seen God's people being oppressed by a foreign land, it's the only language they have available to describe what's actually going on. And so the four beasts represent the arrogant political regimes that use violence and oppression to further their agendas. And if you think that our modern leaders created arrogance, well, then you've not read history, right? Leaders, political leaders, kings, they've all been arrogant. And I mean, Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar was a great one. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar said, let's build a temple and make everybody bow down to it. My favorite king is in the Bible, I mean, other than that's not a king of Israel, it's the king Nimrod of Babylon. His real name was Nimrod. And what did he do? He built the temple to reach God so he could walk up and reach God all on his own. Talk about the height of hubris and arrogance. Right? But that's what, and so what Daniel says is that these four beasts, and when we see the explanation of this vision, this vision deeply troubled Daniel, as it might trouble you. And the explanation of this vision is that the four beasts represent these arrogant political kingdoms that use violence. And there's four of them. There's going to be four. Now, the scholars have tried to debate what the four mean, if the four is even metaphoric. Maybe it's just a metaphor. We don't know. It's hard for us to understand exactly what Daniel had in mind, but we know that they represent kingdoms. And so what's happening? They're fierce beasts, and we have one that looks like a lion, one looks like a leopard, one that looks like a bear. We have lions and leopards and bears. Oh, my. And they are, but the last beast is the worst beast. It is iron teeth. And it's this vicious creature that is able to take over the whole world. Now, he gives us this picture, right? There's one picture. These massive, terrible, fearsome, evil beasts. But there's another, and he splits, and he says, okay, there's this. He says, while I was thinking about this, he says, here's one screen. And while this screen is going on, here's another screen. He says, and I looked, and thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. And that the Ancient of Days represents God. This is who God is, right? And his clothing was as white as snow, the hair on his head white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and his wheels were all ablaze. And he talks about all the people, 10,000 times 10,000, which really represents everybody on earth, right? They came, and it says, and this is what's important. It says the court was seated and the books were opened. What happens is the Ancient of Days, God himself, comes. So remember, we have one screen where the vicious creatures, the vicious beasts, the kingdoms of this earth are waging war and oppressing. But then in another screen, side by side, here's another scene where the great Ancient of Days comes and takes a seat. And what does he say? Court is in session. He opens the books and says, I will now judge and bring justice to the world. Now, I don't know if you, this is the tension that Daniel lives in. Remember the end? The future is secure. We can endure. But he's holding these two things in tension. Right now, the beasts in one screen, the beasts are running amok and destroying everything. And in one scene, God himself is bringing justice to the world. And we live in that tension, right? That's what Daniel lives in. And very often, I tend to focus on one screen more than the other, don't you? Particularly since the one screen is the one that our news media shows us, right? It's the beast controlling the earth. They never see the king seated on his throne who is about to bring justice to the world. Now, so the four beasts represent the arrogant political regimes. But then, listen to this. He says, in my vision, at night, he says, I looked and there was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority and glory and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshiped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. His kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. The one like the son of man approaches God and receives an eternal kingdom. Now, we have already known that the four beasts have been destroyed, and the last beast has been killed utterly. The other beasts are just struggling to try to survive. And the Son of Man approaches God. Now, this is what's difficult for us. The Son of Man, when it says the Son of Man coming, this is where translation hurts us sometimes. The Son of Man is not coming down from heaven to earth. The Son of Man is coming from earth to heaven. Remember, the Son of Man approaches God. He goes up to God. And he is seated by God, and he is given glory and dominion and power, and the people worship him. Now, remember, this is before Jesus. The people of Israel only worship one God. They don't worship anybody else. It's one like the Son of Man goes up, and he is served as if he is God himself. And his dominion will have no end. And what the interpretation, he says, he was troubled by this. And he says, so he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. He says, the four beasts, and this is a very short interpretation, by the way. He says, the four great beasts are the four kings that will rise from the earth, but the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. See, the beasts represent all the kings, all the prideful, arrogant rulers of our world. The Son of Man represents all of God's people. He is the representative of God's people. Now, what Daniel wants us to learn, the message that Daniel has for those who hear his message is this, that one day God is going to bring about an end to all of these regimes in the world. One day God's going to bring justice and peace to the world. And he's going to do it through one like a son of man. And so because of that, we can endure every day. Now, I want you to think about what Daniel is. Daniel is not he's not like Isaiah and Jeremiah. Daniel's not a professional prophet. Daniel has a job. He's got a real job. Like, he has to go to a cubicle, and he works for 70 years. He goes to a cubicle every day and does Babylonian paperwork, right? And he has to go and sit by and talk to people at the water cooler. He's got a cat poster with a hanging saying, hang on till Friday, you know? He's working for the weekend. Daniel lives a regular life. But Daniel says, the reason I can get up every day, the reason that my life has meaning, the reason I can do the everyday things are because I know that God is, that the future is secure. And my work has meaning because of that. And let's face it, here's the thing. Daniel led an amazing life, right? Remember, read the Gospels, you'll know that how does Jesus talk about himself, right? Jesus always says, he calls himself what? The Son of Man. In Mark, he says, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. In fact, Jesus talks about himself in the third person as the Son of Man. And he's God incarnate, so he can do that. Everybody else who talks in the third person is kind of jerky, really. Let's face it. Athletes, presidents, the like, right? But when Jesus does it, he talks about himself as the Son of Man. And he uses it. And so, and scholars and theologians have argued, well, did Jesus really mean Daniel? Was he talking about Daniel? But I want you to look in Matthew chapter 26. And this is verse 63 through 67. And it'll be up on the screen. He says, finally, remember, Jesus has been, he's been in trial, and they've been trying to get him to sort of incriminate himself. They've been trying to figure out, but he won't play their games. And so finally, in 63, the high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. You have said so, said Jesus. Now, I mean, this is one thing that I can imagine him going, oh my gosh, will you just tell us? Right? But listen to what he says. But I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on clouds of heaven. See that? Do you remember that language? It is directly, I mean, it is a straight quote from Daniel chapter 7. And remember, he's not talking about coming as in coming from heaven to earth. It's not what Jesus is talking about. Right? He's using the language of the Son of Man from Daniel 7. Remember, he's coming. Remember, it's going up, not coming down. It's ascent, not descent. Remember, Jesus said, when his death, burial, and resurrection, he remember at the end of his time on earth, what does he do? He ascends to heaven, and he is seated, and he is given glory and dominion and power, and his kingdom shall have no end. But listen to the way they respond. When Jesus says what he says, listen to the way they respond. It says, then the high priest tore his clothes. And he says, he has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, he's done it all of himself. Look now, you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they all answered, he is worthy of death. And then they spit in his face. And they struck him with their fists. And others slapped. I wonder why would this be? Why would this cause this reaction? You see, very often in American, 21st century American Christianity, we believe that Jesus came to bring us a new private, kind of personal way of being related, of relating to God. You know, a new way to have a spiritual experience in the heart. Maybe that's true to some degree, but that's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is talking about revolution. Jesus is talking about the kingdoms of this world going down and his kingdom coming up. Jesus is talking about revolution, but it's not like revolutions we know where there's swords and explosions and death. The only death will be his alone. But because he's talking about revolution, there's only one thing for revolutionaries, and that is death. See, Jesus came to fulfill the role of the Son of Man. And Jesus has, in fact, defeated the great beasts of the earth, sin and death and destruction and hatred and greed, often personified by our governments. And Jesus is now the King of Kings. And I love that we can turn over into Matthew chapter 28 and listen to this. Remember how the Daniel chapter 7 about once the Son of Man comes to the throne to the Ancient of Days and he sits with the Ancient of Days and all authority and glory and power is given to him. And listen to how Jesus ends his time on earth in Matthew. And this is in Matthew 28 verses 16 through 20. He says, then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, the mountain where Jesus had told them to go, and when they saw him, they worshipped him. Remember? Just like they worshipped the Son of Man. But some doubted. And then Jesus came to them and said, listen to what he says. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Just like the Son of Man. All authority and glory and dominion was given him, and his kingdom shall have no end. He says, go therefore and make misunderstand Jesus' intent. Because, and I do this too. Very often, I think, oh, God, I know you've got the end. I know the future is secure, and I can endure, and that's in a rhyme. It goes on a t-shirt. It's great. And I often do this, and I'm kind of lazy, and I'm kind of a hermit, honestly. And so my thing when I hear that, I hear, oh, Jesus has got the future in control. And so what do? I say, well, I'm just going to sit in my office and read dusty old books until you come. Is that what Jesus says at all? No. He said, listen to what he says. He says, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Now get to work. You've got business to do. You got things to take care of. Go make disciples. So often, Christians, we tend to put our head in the sand and we say, oh, God, I hope you'll come and do something good. I can't wait to see it. But what Jesus has called us to do is to join you. God's got this great adventure for us. I don't think he's in such an amazing place. We spend this enormous amount of energy trying to live as if we believe what Jesus is saying, right? Because Jesus doesn't say, one day in the future, all authority on heaven and earth will be given to me. Doesn't say that, does it? That's future tense. What does Jesus say? He says past tense. All authority in heaven and earth has been given. It's actually what we call a perfect tense. It's already said something that happened in the past. What if we lived as if God, Jesus, already had all the authority in heaven and earth? What if we weren't waiting for some day when by and by, Jesus will come and he'll have all the authority? What if we believed that he already had it now? What if we believed that he was already in charge now? What would it look like? And that's one of the things about our church. We try to live as if God already has all the authority. Now, we don't do it. We're not perfect and we fail. But that's what I love about us at PC. We're trying our best to live as if we believe that all authority in heaven and earth has been given to Jesus, that he has called us to serve. Now, the question is, will you join us? Will you join God in this great adventure? And I know it's hard to imagine what this would look like, right? I mean, because many of you say, well, I'm not a minister, and I'm not a missionary, and I'm not an evangelist. What do I do? But we have Daniel as one of our models. We go out and we do our jobs, and we try to be light, and we try to grow where we're planted. So I've got a video. We're going to be closing out. We've done a video as a part of the sermon series, and I want to close out with one last video. I just want you to just imagine, what could God do if we really believed he already had authority? If we really believed that he had already been given all authority in heaven and on earth, and that his kingdom would have no end. Years.
6 says, although the whole world is mine, I want to establish a kingdom of priests and make a holy nation. And I remember thinking, am I a priest? Can I be a minister in business, in the marketplace?
There was a specific point in which Rick had to make a decision. Am I going to stay in control of this, or am I going to let the Lord have control of this? Does God own this business, or do I own this business? He still had the matter to contend with of, well, how are the people going to view this? Not all of them are believers. And in the end, the day came, and he stood before the company, and he said he had given ownership of the company to the Lord. Let's see where he wants to take us.
We just began to make a place for God's kingdom in our business for the purpose of transformation.
We've built homes for more than 7,000 families. Each home you build gives us an opportunity to interact with over 100 businesses and contractors. We view the businesses and contractors as trade partners. Besides dealing with them honestly, paying them regularly, we seek to help them grow their own businesses through loans, providing startup capital, and offering business mentoring. We view building each home at the highest level of quality while keeping the cost affordable as a huge part of our ministry to the families who place their trust in us to build their home. Just before handing over the keys, we present each family with a Bible with their name inscribed on it. We have over 120 employees, and we made the decision to turn our family-owned company into an employee-owned one so they can enjoy the fruit of their labor into their retirement. We developed an intentional relational leadership style where we're looking at the person as a whole. We're actively seeking to grow our employees personally and professionally. We also hired a team dedicated full-time to take care of our employees and our trade partners. God has allowed us to live a life we didn't even know to dream, and we're excited about where He's going to lead us next.
A leader's job here isn't to build homes, but to build people, and nothing has impacted me as much professionally, personally, and spiritually as this place, and it's ridiculous that somebody can say that about a business.
I am just a testament to what can happen here, because people were working on me, refining me, and ultimately transforming my life, making it better for not just me, but my family.
We talk about ministry in the marketplace. Whatever business you're in, that's the Lord's business. Just give Him that business. Go bloom where you're planted and perform ministry right there.